You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. If you're a watcher of old TV police or detective shows, you've heard those words before, right? The so-called Miranda warning or the Miranda rights. The intention is to give the accused of an alleged crime the best chance at a fair trial. Because you can never tell. The things we say may be taken out of context, misunderstood, misrepresented, filtered, selected, rearranged, twisted and contorted to mean things we never intended them to mean. A person accused of some wrongdoing may very well, even if they're trying to defend themselves, may very well unintentionally say something which is nevertheless incriminating, something to imply that they are guilty. So to minimize any chances for an accused person to be misunderstood, we give the right to remain silent until conditions allow for us to have a fair and impartial testimony to be rendered and heard. This week on a visit to Moses Cohen Hospital, I was very surprised to run smack dab into a friend from seminary I hadn't seen in 15 years. He's a pastor in the eastern part of the state, so we're not in the same annual conferences. We don't get together very much, but we hadn't seen each other or in these many years. We rehashed these old times. We laughed about our time together, trying to learn biblical Greek, which you do in a small class setting around tables, and you talk and you laugh and you work on things. And we remembered the friendship that grew over those very fast 3 years. Ben is one of those very easygoing, jolly, funny, self-deprecating jokesters. If Ben strings together two serious sentences, one after the other, it is a rarity. Just about everything he says is something meant to make you laugh. And I was shocked to hear him recall, word for word, things that we said to each other more than 15 years ago. Word for word. And sometimes that can be a little bit disconcerting, can't it? To hear these casual, off-the-cuff, passing remarks that we said to each other, and that I said, remembered with piercing clarity. Some of my statements were treasured as encouraging words of inspiration, even if I didn't mean them to be so. Sometimes my words were repeated back to me with more bite and abrasiveness than I would have really wanted them to have, also without any intention on my part. I may never have intended to express so much or so strongly, for so much good or for so much ill. Yet hearing how others sometimes attribute unintended significance to what they hear from me, there are surely those times I look back and I think I wish that I had remained silent. I doubt very much I'm alone in this. I'll leave you with that discomforting thought. Some of the things that we say to each other are going to be remembered by other people, maybe with not the same intention that we meant them to have. I think we'd all be shocked to learn how others really perceive many of the things that we say, but never intend to mean. I think we're all liable to be understood in ways that we never intend. I think we are all capable of being more memorable than we wish that we were. Precisely why the judicial system grants us this right to remain silent. 2,000 years before Miranda, Jesus remained curiously silent. When he was asked point blank by Pilate that question that everybody really wants Jesus to answer directly and unambiguously, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Why doesn't Jesus just come out and say it? "Yep, that's me, king of the Jews, the Messiah, rightful heir of David's throne, king of all Israel, king of all the world, as a matter of fact, even your Roman Empire. King of kings, Lord of lords, Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last, the Almighty, the King of creation. Why doesn't Jesus just come out and say it? The writing's on the wall. Everybody knows it. There's nothing he's going to say to Pilate that's going to make his fate any easier. Next stop for Jesus, Golgotha. Four nails and a cross. Nothing that Jesus says at this point is going to help him in that fate. So why not make it clear? Why not make the definitive declaration to the world in front of Pilate? Yes, I am the King of the Jews. But instead, Jesus almost seems to bend over backwards to avoid giving a direct answer. Do you ask this on your own? Or did others tell you about me? You say that I'm a king. I was born and I came into the world for this, to testify to the truth. The closest that Jesus ever comes in this exchange is to say that my kingdom is not of this world. Still, you don't get the impression that Jesus is all that eager to claim the title, king. Why do you think that is? Could it be that Jesus still knows something important about human nature, especially when it comes to human nature, which is tainted by the power of sin? Could it be that Jesus is being acutely aware that no matter what he says, that no matter how precisely and authoritatively and genuinely he says it, there is still this tremendous danger that people will hear something very different from what he means? That people will hear what they want to hear more than hearing what Jesus actually intends to say. Jesus is tantalizingly, elusively resistant to claiming the title of king. He remains silent on the subject, even when he is directly asked. Perhaps it is because of the unhelpful associations that we human beings make with kings and kingships. Perhaps Jesus wants to avoid the worldly stereotypes that we harbor of kings, so that Jesus can then redefine God's dominion over Christ's kingdom on heaven and on earth. You got to remember, you think back to the Old Testament, kingship was never God's intention. Kingship was never God's idea for the redemptive purposes that he held for Israel. We want a king, the Israelites complained and begged. We want to be like the other nations. They have kings. And they keep strutting their stuff in front of us and pushing us around. God, we want a king. And God warned them, you don't need a king. You have me. I'm better than a king. A king will make you pay taxes. A king will make you fight and die in his wars. A king will make you into slavery. He'll steal your daughters for his harems. A king will live fat and happy on your sweat and blood. God's very intention was that Israel would live under divine authority, and in so doing, bless the world by being a convincingly blessed alternative to life under human rule of kings. But, you know, you can't tell people anything. No, 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 we insist. God, we want a king. We want a king. And God gives in to their demands very reluctantly. God tries to make the best of it, reserving the right to choose the kings that he wants. Still, there's only so much that God will do to make his kings behave themselves. And David and his descendants and the other kings that God chooses for Israel proceed to make a general mess of everything that God had intended to redeem the world through Israel, through God's chosen people. So there's one less than stellar picture of kings and kingships that I imagine that Jesus is not all that eager to be able to associate himself with. The other thing about kings is our propensity to associate kingship with things like superiority and dominance. and hierarchy. Sometimes we want a king in order to elevate our own authority and strength and to be able to say, well, my guy is king. My guy has won national championships. My guy has won more Sprint Cup titles. My guy is the best. Your guy is not. We are better than you because our guy is the real king. Our king rules, therefore we rule. We're the best because our king is the best. Isn't that exactly the mistake God has tried to get the Israelites to avoid? We want a king because we want a king to serve our purposes. We want a king on our terms, to do our bidding, to exert power and influence on our behalf, so that those other countries won't run us over, so that those other people won't think they're better than we are. Now, don't get me wrong. Our guy, Jesus, is the best. There's no doubt about that. Truly, Jesus reigns supreme. Jesus is sovereign, meaning there is no one greater. That's what it means to say Jesus is Lord, to say that Jesus' authority takes precedence over all other authorities, including our own personal decision-making. When Jesus is Lord of my life, that means I defer to him. I defer to his way of doing things. I defer to his rules. However, the way that Jesus' kingship is like none other, the way that Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, is that Jesus never equates his supremacy with superiority. And Jesus never, ever suggests intentions of establishing a society of hierarchies and rankings and some people being better than others. When asked the all-important question, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus remains silent. Jesus avoids and resists calling himself king. Jesus resists our earthbound definitions of king. He repudiates the labels and insinuations of superiority and supremacy. Jesus refuses to indulge our thirst for power and influence and prestige and privilege that comes from owning who our king is. Jesus denies our attempts to leverage his kingships to underwrite our delusions of strength and control and entitlement. Jesus is king, but his version of king and kingship are totally different from the self-serving versions that we want them to be. Jesus' kingdom is non-hierarchical, non-ranking, no way of saying who is better than someone else. In Jesus' kingdom, everybody is valuable. Everybody is priceless. Everybody is important. In Jesus' kingdom, power is redefined through submission on a cross. In Jesus' kingdom, superiority is redefined by befriending societies lowly and rejected and forgotten. The poor, the imprisoned, the diseased, even the enemy. In Jesus' kingdom, to lead is to serve. To be first is to be last. To meet a stranger is to offer hospitality. To have an enemy is to forgive and reconcile. Today, at the end of the church's calendar year, we celebrate this ultimate goal of God's redeeming work on the universe that he created. We celebrate the complete redemption of sin and the perfect and gracious reign of Jesus Christ that will come. We also remember how Jesus remained silent rather than adopting our earthbound language of kings and kingship. Maybe we also hear in the silence something of an indication of unfinished business, an answer that is yet to be spoken by Christ before Pilate, but spoken loud and clear on the cross. in an empty tomb, in a great commission, go, make disciples of all nations. For us today, the Lord's kingdom is incomplete. It's kind of here, but it's not fully here yet. We as his church must continue living Jesus' answer until he comes to make the kingdom come in its fullness. We may not remain silent.